What's up, Revision Online? You guys doing good this morning? You're looking good. I bet. I don't know. That's a dumb way to introduce an online service. But either way, I'm excited to be here with you. Glad you tuned in from wherever you are. So this week, I was chasing my twins around the house because you can't chase them anywhere else. It's hashtag social distancing time. And I caught up to them and wrestled them both to the couch in our living room right as a lady who lives down the street was walking by the house. And I caught her eye and realized she probably thinks that I am like quarantined out already and I'm in here just murdering my kids. But the good news is she probably won't stop and try and help them because she doesn't want to get sick. So that's a win. And the whole thing kind of reminded me of a different chasing a kid incident that happened a few years ago. It was one of those times where I was so completely caught up in a moment, I didn't even stop to think about anything else. My daughter Emma was about 4 years old, and Jenny asked me to go get her out of the bath. So I did, and I dried her off, and I told her, all right, now we gotta go get our pajamas on. And then she looked at me with a sly little grin and said, catch me. And then she took off running. And every dad watching this knows there's only one thing you can do when your naked little kid says, catch me. You go catch him. That's it. So I yelled, oh, I'm going to catch you. And I took off running after her. And I chased this giggling, nude, shifty little girl down the hallway and down the stairs and across the house until I finally caught up with her right in front of our wide open front windows. And she laughed and screamed. And the random strangers who were walking by on the street turned and looked. And there we were. Emma wearing nothing, and me only just realizing all I had on were socks and a pair of boxers. I have never stopped feeling bad for those poor people. But the thing is, I was so focused on the fun and joy and silly beauty of that little moment, nothing else mattered. I think moments like that are the times when we feel most fully alive. When all our burdens and cares, all our fears and anxieties, all our worries about what other people think of us just melt away. But sadly, for many of us, those times are few and far between. A lot of us feel like we mostly exist in a space defined by frustration and fear, especially in the middle of a global pandemic that has radically disrupted our lives and left us flying blind in a sea of uncertainty. We're scared about what the future holds, overwhelmed by the problems of the present, and as we shift to almost entirely digital engagement with the world around us, we're even more concerned than ever about other people's perceptions of us. Social media takes our natural inclination to obsess over whether and how people might be judging us and just feeds it steroids. And the reason all of this feels so heavy is that we were built, like we're wired together for something better. We were made to live fully alive. And there's something we can learn from David about how to do that. For those of you who are joining Revision for the very first time this morning, welcome. We're pumped that you're here. We're in the middle of a series of messages we've been calling The Warrior Poet, where we've been taking a look at the life of David in the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, which is the longest, most detailed story of a human life in all of ancient literature, which means it's also the best picture in antiquity that we get of what makes or breaks a human life. And at this point, we've followed him from the time that he was like a kid out tending sheep in the fields through some crazy twists and turns until he's a king ruling over the entire nation of Israel. And when I say crazy twists and turns, I mean it. If we can have an honest moment here, the author of 1 and 2 Samuel has a flair for the dramatic. In these books, we've got a giant being beheaded, a ghost coming back from the dead and telling a guy, like, you're gonna get killed and strung up on a wall, a king pooping in a cave, and later a guy's hair getting caught in a tree while his donkey runs out from underneath him and he's just hanging there swinging like a pinata. It's like this stuff was written for middle school boys. That's the target audience, I think. And I also think I was a middle school boy the first time I remember reading the section we're gonna take a look at today. And in my Bible, and maybe in yours too, if you have a Bible with you, crack it open to 2 Samuel 6 and check. But in my Bible, it had a little subtitle above it that said, David dances naked before the Lord. Which, that's a clickbait Bible headline, because he was only half naked. But this is a real story in the Bible. And I know I say this all the time, but seriously, you guys should read it. It's an amazing, hilarious, incredible book, and today, I really believe all of us have something powerful to learn from David dancing half naked, like about who God is and who we were created to be. We have something to learn that'll help us not just survive, but thrive during this season of crisis. Because this may not be the most famous moment in David's life, but it's probably the one that best sums up the theme of his life, that we are in desperate need of the immediate presence of God. We're in desperate need of the immediate presence of God. And when he shows up and we see him for who he is and realize how massively he loves us, it changes everything. It sets us free to live every moment fully alive. And here's how David discovered that. This is what went down that ended with him dancing like a fool in the streets. He's now the king over all Israel, and he decides it's time to bring the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem. Now, some of you are thinking, what is the Ark of the Covenant? Is that the thing Indiana Jones was trying to find in Raiders of the Lost Ark? Yes, it is. But in real life, here's what it was all about to David and to the ancient Israelites. It was a box. The Hebrew word we translate ark literally means chest. So it's a wooden box overlaid with gold. It's about 4 feet long by 2.5 feet wide. And inside it were the stone tablets that contained the Ten Commandments God had originally written out for Moses. And on top, there was a golden lid with two golden angels facing each other. It was called the mercy seat, the place where God sat to extend judgment and mercy to his people. And it was a really important piece of the tabernacle, which was the mobile temple that the nation of Israel set up while they wandered around the desert for years and years, and they eventually set up more permanently in the Promised Land. But the ark wasn't just any piece of furniture. It had its own special room in the temple, in the tabernacle. And the high priest went into that room only once per year to offer a sacrifice to make atonement for the sins of the entire nation. And there was a cloud that hovered over the ark that symbolized God's presence with his people, like his glory. And God's present everywhere, and he was present everywhere, and they knew that. But this was an important symbol of his presence. And it was so holy that nobody was allowed to touch it. And nobody was even allowed to go into the room in the tabernacle that housed it, other than the high priest, one time per year. Like, pretty cool, right? Except at this point in time, when we pick up David's story in 2 Samuel 6, the ark wasn't where it was supposed to be. Like 20 years earlier, some unfaithful idiot priests, without actually praying or asking God what to do, had decided to cart it out to battle as kind of a good luck charm. And God just loves being used like he's a magic genie. No, he doesn't, actually. That's not true at all. And so Israel lost the battle, and the ark got captured by their enemies, the Philistines. But everywhere the Philistines took it, it brought curses. And so they thought, this thing is bad news. And they just loaded it on a cart with some oxen and slapped the oxen and sent them in the direction of Israel. They're like, we just got to get this thing out of here. And for a long time, it had just been in a room in some guy's house, and nobody went in there. And David decides, this isn't cool. We need to bring it back to the tabernacle, back to the place it belongs. Not because it's magic, not because God is inaccessible without it, but because it's a reminder of the personal, immediate, powerful presence of a transcendent God. And David wanted that. He knew he wouldn't survive as king without that. He was desperate for the immediate presence of God, and he was aware that what he really needed wasn't just an intellectual belief that God loved him, but like an intimate connection with that God. One that was so spiritually real to him, he could live for an audience of one. He could reign as king unconcerned about everyone else's approval, not terrified constantly about what people thought of him and how they might be judging him, not anxious about an unknown future or afraid of all the things that could go wrong. David knew what he needed most, like to bring him peace and hope, to fill up the space of longing inside his soul, was God. And so he was determined to bring the ark back to Jerusalem. Not as like a tool or a vehicle to gain access to God, but as a reminder of how critical God's presence is. He wanted God at the center of his life, his nation, and his culture. And so we read in 2 Samuel chapter 6, David again brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000. He and all his men went to Bala in Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim on the ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. All right, so here we are. The Ark is on its way to Jerusalem, and when we get there, at the end of this chapter, what we find is a king dancing half naked like a madman, just celebrating his face off in front of the whole nation, alongside the whole nation, like so caught up in the love and presence of God, and the beauty of that moment, he doesn't have a care in the world. He's completely free from worry and self-consciousness. But here's the deal. It's actually what happens in the middle of this chapter, like along the journey to Jerusalem, that makes David's rejoicing possible. Because there are a couple weird twists along the way that leave David confused and angry before he truly gets it. And the first one happens in verse 6. we read that they were like going along the road right by this guy named Nacon's house, and Uzzah, one of the people who lived in the house where the ark had been kept for a lot of years, saw the oxen who were pulling the cart stumble. And he reached out his hand and he touched the ark to steady it. And he dropped dead right there. And we hear that. And if you're anything like me, you think, that is so unfair. Why would God do that? It seems like Uzzah was just trying to help. Like, if God's going to do stuff like that, if the barrier to being in God's presence is making zero mistakes or else he'll just kill you, then I don't know if I actually do want the presence of God. Like, it's scary. And you guys, that's exactly how David felt. Verse 8 says, then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day, and he said, how can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. So this whole thing goes down, and Uzzah drops dead, and David gets confused and mad. He says, forget this. I'm leaving it here. And he drops it off at a guy's house, and he goes home. And I love that the Bible is so honest. It's just raw and real. I think sometimes people reject the Bible because things in it offend them, and they assume they're like the first generation to find it offensive. Not true. God has been offending people for thousands of years. And the Bible offends even its heroes, its writers, and its main characters. David is mad at God right now. He's going, look, man, I was trying to do you a favor. I was trying to help people put you at the center of their lives. And like, this is what you're doing? This is how you repay me? That was a bad call. That was too harsh of a punishment. I'm out. I'm going home. And he did that because there's something he didn't understand that many of us don't understand either. What he did understand, and Uzzah understood too, is that they were not supposed to touch the ark. But Uzzah was just trying to help out, right? Just trying to keep the ark from hitting the ground and getting dirty, because the ground is dirty, right? And Uzzah assumes his hand is less dirty than the dirt. But he's wrong. Because the dirt hasn't rejected God, sinned against him, try to control him. The mud and the grass haven't rebelled against his holiness. See, it wasn't the ground that would pollute the ark, it was the people. And Uzzah touched it because he believed God needed his help. He believed he had something to offer. He believed he could bridge the gap between him and God. And here's what we got to understand today if we're going to truly experience the love and presence of God. That gap is a chasm. It's so big, we can't do anything to reach across it. God is so holy, and we are so broken and messed up that he's untouchable. And what God's doing here when Uzzah drops dead isn't exacting some sort of unjust punishment or revenge. He's demonstrating the justice that all of us deserve. God's saying, look, if you think you can make a way between you and me, if you minimize me that much, you reject the gospel at its core. See, this chasm is so big. Not only can you not bridge it, I can't bridge it. God's saying, I can't just snap my fingers and pretend that it's all okay. That would violate who I am and who I made you to be and the way things are. There has to be atonement. There's a price that has to be paid to reconnect what's been broken, to bridge this gap. And that price isn't your effort or your good works or your ability to help or your ability to check boxes of being a good person or being a religious superstar. Forget that. The price is blood. Ultimately, it's the blood of the Messiah, the one I'm going to send, my own son, to shed his blood once for all so that this chasm can be crossed. But David doesn't quite get that message yet. I mean, he gets the message that there's a gap, but he thinks, well, I guess there's no hope for crossing it. So he leaves the ark right where it is. And the guy's house, he leaves it in. Like, that guy starts experiencing massive, crazy, inexplicable blessings. And it finally clicks for David. There is a way to connect to God. But it's dependent on God, not us. And now, in this moment, he understands the essence of the gospel, both its bad news and its good news. And here's the gospel. The bad news is you are more sinful and broken than you have ever dared to believe. But the good news is, at the same time, you are more loved and accepted than you've ever dared to imagine. God is chasing you down, even though you've rejected him, because that's how crazy his love is for you. And once David sees that, everything changes. And he goes to get the ark, and he explains it to the whole nation, and everybody is floored by the goodness of God in the face of our brokenness, and they worship. Like, worship is a word that ultimately means bowing down to the one greatest thing. the thing you love most and need most, the thing to which you've ascribed the ultimate value in your life. And we all worship something. We all worship something, and our capacity for worship is measured by our understanding of the gap between our sinfulness and God's holiness. Like, our ability to worship Him is measured by how conscious we are of the fact that there's a chasm between us. And when we understand it rightly, we get a bigger, better picture of His love. And it does something profound in us. It melts away our cares and our worries and our fears, and it allows us to live fully alive. That's what we see in David. We read this: wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all of his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. And David here, he's basically wearing just a vest and some like linen shorts, and he's dancing like a crazy person, like a commoner, like a peasant without a care in the world, because he's connected intimately to the God of the universe, and he knows that the one who hung the stars in place cares about him. And what happens next is like my favorite marriage fight in the entire Bible. I so resonate with it. He gets home and his wife looks at him and says, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in view of the slave girls and his servants as any vulgar fellow would." She's super embarrassed. And she's embarrassed because she's missed the point. She thinks David's not acting like a king, not properly holding himself like a royal noble should in public. And remember, she was a princess. She's Saul's daughter, so she's super conscious of all this stuff. But David's like, "Oh man, you missed it. See, your dad thought being a king was all about people giving him glory. But God fired him and picked me. And the reason is, I get it, that this whole king thing is about me pointing people towards God's glory. Like, that's what I'm doing. I'm not worried about me. I'm worried about God." And then he does the marriage thing where he cranks the fight up to 11. And it so reminds me of my own marriage. Like, one time when we were first married, Jenny told me that I had put too much peanut butter on my toast. And I was just epically offended by that. I was just like, "Too much peanut butter? Too much? You think this is too much peanut butter? You haven't seen too much peanut butter. You watched me peanut butter some toast." And I just took like one of the big spoons and I put a huge additional scoop of peanut butter on just to prove my point, because I was really good at marriage back then. And but David, he looks at her and she just called him undignified. And I love this line. This is my motto in worship. And I pray it can become yours too, because it's beautiful and it's liberating. He says, "Undignified? You think dancing for God and worshiping like this is undignified? Well, I will become even more undignified than this. And I'll be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." I'll become even more undignified than this. He says, "I don't care what anybody thinks. God's love is so good. I just want to point people to it. That's the purpose of my life." And for all of you, wherever you're at this morning, wherever you're tuning in from, I want to encourage you to let the love of God wash over you. Every single one of us rejected God, turned our backs on Him, and nothing we could do could ever earn our way back into His presence. But instead of abandoning us to our brokenness, He stepped out of eternity into history and He gave His life so we could be forgiven and set free. And if you've never trusted that, you can this morning. All you have to do is believe. It's free. But for us, like in this season we're living in, the season of fear and uncertainty, and in the middle of a society where it's so easy to be crippled by what others might think of us, worship is how we find freedom. Like, let's become undignified. Even more undignified than this is as we enjoy the beauty of God's love. We are desperate for the immediate presence of God, and when we experience it, when we allow His grace and His hope and His love to wash over us, we can't help but find liberation from all of our fear and all of our anxiety, as we find ourselves just caught up in the beauty of being loved and accepted. Just so immersed in the joy of the moment. Just like half naked Mike was when I was chasing my daughter. Just like half naked David was when he was dancing in the streets. We find ourselves so caught up in the beauty of it that we're living fully alive as we worship the only one who is worthy. I just want to invite you into that today. Will you guys pray with me? God, thank you. Thank you for loving us enough not to leave us in this space where we're broken. Thank you for making a way where we couldn't make a way, making a way back to us. Thank you for loving us enough to step out of eternity into history and give your life so that we could be forgiven and set free. God, would you just convince us of your love today. In this time where so many of us don't know what the future holds, where so many of us are afraid and anxious about what is to come in the days and the weeks and the months that are out ahead of us, would you just wash away all of that anxiety in your love as we remember today who you are? And we just worship you for who you are. And we praise you because of your love. Would you let us just worship you in a way that makes us fully alive? God, thank you for giving us life. In Jesus' name, amen.